Hello. How good of you to call on me after all this time. Please come in. Step into the library. What a summer we've had. Let me take your coat. I'll dry it by the fire. Now you've caught me in the middle of something. Oh no, I'm glad you did. One needs the occasional distraction. I've been preparing notes for a lecture on Irish ghost stories. How they arise, where they arise, why they arise. Listen to this. Sometimes a ghost may be nothing more or less than the troubled conscience of a community. Take, for example, but then you hardly want to hear that story. Oh, you do? Oh, excellent. Well, draw a little closer and tell me what you think. I should warn you, by the way, and not to titillate, that this is a true and a tragic story from the dark annals of Irish history. I'll recount it respectfully, and I encourage you to receive it in the same spirit. Now, on the 21st of December, 1895, the Moresby set sail from Cardiff, carrying almost 2,000 tons of coal. The Moresby was a three-masted ship based out of Liverpool, and its voyage under Captain Caleb Coomer was to take it from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from a northern winter to a southern summer. Its final destination was the port of Pisagua in northern Chile. The Moresby never made it that far. Just 2 days into its journey, the ship ran into a storm off the southeastern coast of Ireland. Conditions were dire and worsening all the time. The ship's international crew, which hailed from all over Britain and Europe, knew they were in deep and mortal danger. They could sense death in the roaring winds and rearing waves. About 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Captain Coomer guided the ship into Dungarvan Bay, off the coast of County Waterford. The crew dropped anchor off Ballinacorty Lighthouse, hoping to wait out the storm in the shelter of the bay. It was a forlorn hope. At 4:30 a.m. on Christmas Eve, the ship's anchor snapped and the Moresby tilted onto its side. The crew and the captain's wife and young daughter, who were also on board, clung on desperately until 11 a.m. when, losing hope of any rescue from the shore, they summoned up their courage, leapt into the dark, churning waters, and swam for their lives. Few of the crew made it far, alive that is. Of the 25 crew, only 5 would eventually be rescued by the Ballinacorty lifeboat. As for Captain Coomer, his wife Edith, and their little daughter Ivy, their bodies washed up on the beach a few days later. Ivy, who had been born at sea just 2 years earlier, died at sea, strapped to her father's back as he made the desperate plunge into the dark waters. The family were buried, along with some of Captain Coomer's shipmates, in a mass grave in St. Mary's Churchyard. The Moresby's teenage apprentices were buried separately, and chilling pictures still exist of 3 mounds of earth in the wintry churchyard, piled up side by side beneath a row of spindly, leafless trees. In the aftermath of the tragedy, an inquiry pointed the finger at the local coast guard for failing to act appropriately as the Moresby lay stranded in the bay. Well, whoever was to blame, the Moresby continued to haunt Dungarvan in one way or another for years thereafter. The wreck of the Moresby, which was an iron-hulled ship, became a genuine danger to life and limb. Several ships and boats collided with its remains and sank in the bay, until the wreckage was eventually blown up by dynamite. But Dungarvan never forgot the Moresby, and just possibly the dead of the Moresby never forgot Dungarvan. In the spring of 1900, strange events were reported in the vicinity of the Protestant schoolhouse, located within the churchyard of St. Mary's, and close, as many people noted, to the graves of the Moresby sailors. The reports spread like a plague around Dungarvan. No one knew who had seen it first, but everyone knew what had been seen. And what had been seen was this. A dark figure, the figure of a woman, who walked silently through the schoolhouse at night and sat herself at the harmonium. I don't know if you've ever heard a harmonium played, but it's an eerie sound at the best of times. Hand me that record if you would. So imagine how the terrified witness felt as the shadowy lady ran her fingers over the keys and began to play. The music that drifted down the lonely corridors was described as funereal. It was too much for the witness, who ran away. But when they returned the next day, they found no trace of the figure, except for the clay finger marks smeared across the keyboard. Although no one spoke her name, the suggestion that the dark lady might just have been Captain Coomer's wife, Edith, was never far from the townsfolk's minds. As word of the sighting spread, children began to flock to the churchyard, and reports became more and more outlandish. The ghost became first a nun, and then a towering male figure, armed with an enormous broadsword. Well, such is the logic of nightmares. They fray at the edges before they disappear. But the cold, hard kernel at the core of this nightmare, the fate of the Moresby and the town's failure to save its crew, still haunts Dungarvan to this day. Just last year, a proposal to remove a commemorative buoy from the harbour met with a furious response. It's as though the people of Dungarvan, having failed the men, women, and children of the Moresby once, are wary of the consequences of doing so again. Do me a favour, would you, and just toss that log on the fire. Seems to be a bit of a chill creeping in. It's the wind whipping off the sea, I suppose. Harbinger of autumn, perhaps. Now, what else might... Ah, yes. This is a good one, and a true one. All dutifully reported in the newspapers. All signed, sealed, witnessed, and vouched for. Pour yourself another cup, and we'll begin. The city of Kilkenny, in the southeast of Ireland, is one of the most ancient and scenic in the country. At the heart of the city is the impressive bulk of Kilkenny Castle. Now, Kilkenny Castle has seen them all come and go. The Normans, the Gaelic Irish, Cromwell's armies, the indolent aristocracy. What was once a squat, defensive Norman fortress is now a sprawling castle complex, adapted to the whims and tastes of the ruling classes down the ages. Its spectacular picture gallery, the longest room in Ireland, it said, and its Moorish staircase are rightly famous. But when the Butler dynasty finally abandoned the castle in the 1960s, it swiftly fell into ruin. Today it's been impressively restored as a monument to the power, privilege and vanity of all those who lorded it over the people of Kilkenny for 800 years. But even when the Butlers gave up the ghost, the castle itself was not yet ready to give up its own ghosts. Just before 9 a.m, on Thursday the 6th of August, 1992, park attendant Liam Burke was making the rounds of the castle park. He just finished feeding the ducks in the secluded lake at the furthest edge of the grounds, when he noticed a refuse bin overflowing with waste paper. As Liam bent to empty the bin, a very strange feeling passed through him. He had the overwhelming sensation of eyes boring into the back of his head. He turned around and, well, in his own words, "I saw a woman beside me. She was no more than about 2 feet away. She was wearing a long, bluish-coloured dress. To me it looked extremely tight at the waist. She had a big wide hat with ribbons coming down from it. The woman's mouth was opening and closing, but I couldn't hear any sound. She appeared to be hovering slightly off the ground. Like many, many sober, level-headed people who've witnessed such things, Liam insisted to the Kilkenny People newspaper that he did not personally believe in ghosts, and yet he found himself affected not just mentally, but physically by this apparition. "I couldn't get my hand out of the bin, and I couldn't get my feet to move," he told the newspaper. "I don't know how long I was there, but it seemed like hours." As suddenly as the apparition appeared, it disappeared. The figure vanished. As Liam put it, "I don't know if she went up or down or sideways. She was just gone." But even as the woman disappeared and Liam gained control of his body again, he could still feel her presence nearby somehow. Not only that, but his surroundings had changed too. The path, he said, was the same, but the wood wasn't. As a man intimately familiar with this landscape, Liam was convinced that things were out of place, out of joint. The field he'd worked every day for 3 years was no longer there. Liam continued along the path, growing ever more startled and confused, until he reached the castle's burial grounds, the resting place of the Earls of Ormond. There, he caught sight of his colleague, Deirdre O'Keefe. "And when I saw her," Liam told reporters, "everything went back to normal. It was as if I had travelled through time. But I know that's not possible." Liam was prepared for people to scoff at his story. "I know that people will be saying things about me, but I don't care," he said. "I'm as normal as the rest, but I know what I saw." And indeed, some did scoff. Harry Lewis, the former night watchman, had spent 6 nights a week at the castle for over 2 years, and while he did find the atmosphere somewhat spooky, he never saw anything untoward there. No evidence of ghosts, spirits, or apparitions of any kind. But others backed up Liam's story. A man wrote to the Kilkenny people to share his own experience. In 1977, this man and his girlfriend were strolling the canal bank on a pleasant April's evening. The canal walk runs by the castle, and the couple stopped for a breather on a stone seat carved into the castle walls. As they looked out across the river into the gathering evening gloom, the man spotted a figure on the opposite bank of the river. Nothing so alarming about that, except when the figure began to float out across the river. This was no solitary delusion. The man's girlfriend spotted the figure too, and when she saw it, she began to scream. Whatever was gliding across the river had nothing that could be called a face, but it was definitely female, and it was definitely floating straight towards them. And they were terrified. They did the only thing they could think of to defend themselves. They blessed themselves over and over and over again, and then they ran. They ran like scalded cats back towards town, and they didn't stop or look back until they reached the safety of Canal Square, and the figure they hoped was far behind them. The next day, the couple went back to the site of the apparition, just to make sure there was nothing. A rock, a dangling branch, the reflection of a streetlight that might have produced the effect. They found nothing. But they did tell the story to others. And that night, some of the young man's friends ventured down to the canal bank, armed with crucifixes. Now this was a light-hearted, mocking exorcism. The men jogged along, laughing and joking, swinging their crucifixes like batons, and calling on the spirit to give them a sign. They got a sign, all right, because all at once, every single streetlight along the canal walk suddenly winked out, plunged into total darkness. The men lost their cool and pelted back towards town. "I think," our witness said 15 years later, "that they might still be running." So, that's the case for those who believe that the castle and its environs are truly haunted. And you have to admit, it's a chilling and compelling one. Now, far be it from me to tangle with the spectres of Kilkenny Castle, but I do want to make one observation. On the day that Liam Burke saw his old-fashioned lady in blue, the day he had the sensation of travelling back through time, something else might have been afoot in Castle Park. On the very same day that the local newspaper reported Liam's sighting, it also reported that preparations were underway for an open-air Arts Week pageant in the grounds of Kilkenny Castle. staged by the Kilkenny Youth Theatre. The pageant would feature goddesses, 8-foot puppets, dragons, eagles, and a banshee. Could Liam's spectral figure from the past have been nothing more than an amateur actor in costume, lingering in the park on the way to a dress rehearsal? Or could it, as some suspected, have been some surviving essence of Lady Eleanor Butler, who was said to closely resemble the woman Liam described? Well, before we close the door on either explanation, let's reflect on one final unexplained event from the castle's modern history. In 1979, Kilkenny Castle played host to an exhibition of Irish patchwork design, quite the draw in 1979. Crowds were expected, and to measure them, an electronic counter was installed at the entrance to the Long Gallery. The counter dutifully recorded the throngs breezing through the Long Gallery for a look at the patchwork, but it also recorded something else. Because every night, long after the guests and the staff had gone home, and the castle had been locked up, the counter kept ticking. Something was triggering the sensor on its way into the Long Gallery several times a night. The counter was checked, found to be working, and eventually replaced with another system, but the nocturnal visits continued. It was as if something that belonged in the castle couldn't tear itself away from the earthly riches of the paintings and the tapestries and the marble fittings of the Long Gallery. Or maybe it was rats, who can say. But if you ever do get a chance to visit Kilkenny Castle, do try and stick to the tour route. Because who knows what might be lurking on the other side of the velvet rope. Now, I have two more stories I'd like to try out on you, with your consent, of course. Both true, both fully attested. One lighter of heart, and the other more tragic. Which shall we have first? I thought so. Let's lighten the tone. Although, well, let's just tell it as it happened. Now, the common wisdom will tell you that Ireland in the 1970s was a dull, damp, dreary place where nothing ever changed, where each day was much the same as the last. Well, there's certainly some truth in that, but the slower pace of life did sometimes allow people to think and breathe and live a little more. And in the County Kerry town of Tralee, that freedom of sorts led certain locals to some rather dark places. I want to put you in the room where it all happened. Close your eyes. Now, picture yourself in an ordinary terraced house facing onto a green space. Kind of horseshoe council development built all over Ireland in the first half of the 20th century. It's called Marion Park, by the way. And it's Marion by name, Marion by nature. Staunchly Catholic, staunchly respectable in that very Catholic way. But I said I'd put you in the room. Let's close the glass-paneled door behind us, make our way towards the stairs, carefully up the thick stair carpet, onto the landing, past the lurid image of the Sacred Heart on the wall, and into the room itself. It's dark. The curtains are closed. It would be a lot darker but for the candles. There must be 10 of them laid out on the table. And as your eyes adjust to their flickering light, you make out the rest. The tarot cards, a full deck, face up on the table. The vials of exotic and toxic herbs. The full-sized and very real human skull. Resting, if that's the word, beside the crystal ball. And standing eerily upright, the full-sized model of a veiled vampiric woman. Such was the sight that greeted Jean Featherston of the Kerryman newspaper behind the walls of this anonymous council house in Tralee in January of 1971. She had come to interview Michael O'Sullivan in what she called his Museum of Magic. Michael, a young factory worker, fascinated by the occult and the esoteric, was a member of the Tralee Psychic Research Society. Although, as he was quick to point out, he was no heathen. In fact, Michael described himself as a devout Catholic looking to find God, albeit in a somewhat unconventional manner. Among his many other experiments and explorations of the unknown, Michael was attempting to master the art of astral projection, and boasted that his efforts had taken him, mentally at least, as far as the United States, although curiously he found he could only project in his sleep. But Michael wasn't the only member of the Tralee Psychic Research Society. In fact, its driving force was a man called Kenneth Sheffield, an English expat from Leicestershire, who had settled in James Connolly Park, Tralee, where the society met regularly to commune with the dead, or at least with an entity called Minzar. According to Sheffield, as far as we can gather, Minzar used to be a Zen Buddhist, and he spoke to the group via the Ouija board. Although in what some might call typical Kerry fashion, the members of the society were less than impressed with Minzar's quality of service. When asked to prove his powers by passing on a message that only the outsider, the journalist Miss Featherston, would understand, Minzar responded, "If I have to, then we have no faith or very little, but if she cares to follow the paths of mysticism, she will be enlightened." All his answers are vague like that, Sheffield complained to Miss Featherston. So much for Minzar. But despite these underwhelming results, the group's efforts were enough to impress Kerry's greatest living writer, the novelist and playwright John B. Keane, who sent them a cheque and made a public statement of support. "No one is certain what exists in the elements around us," he told the Kerryman. "I am all for these young people. It would be a damn sight worse if they were a bunch of vandals. What they are doing can only benefit the community." So with John B. on their side and the group's resident faith healer, Bob Rusk, making a name for himself as a curer of migraines, the group's fortunes were on the up. But the society had its sights set on the holy grail of psychic research, stalking and capturing a genuine ghost. In March of 1971, the Tralee Group joined forces with the Society for the Recording, Research and Investigation of Natural and Unnatural Phenomena in Cork, crossing a county boundary that's as formidable, at least, as the border between this world and the next. Their objective? An abandoned cottage in the village of Barraduff, about 7 miles outside Killarney, where a ghostly nun was said to walk. Indeed, sightings of the nun had been quite frequent and widespread over the previous months. To the surprise of locals, who insisted that the cottage had only been temporarily abandoned due to a family emergency, the Cork Society, which was said to include members of all religious denominations, two doctors, a company director, and what was described as a lady solicitor, would be bringing extra sensitive photographic and audio equipment in the hope of capturing at least a record of their spectral quarry. And so, the awesome combined forces of the Tralee Society for Psychic Research and the Society for the Recording, Research and Investigation of Natural and Unnatural Phenomena in Cork lay in wait outside the village of Barraduff. It was to be an eventful vigil. Moans, bumps, knocks and groans were heard coming from the house, and the nun-like figure was spotted more than once. Had Ken and his comrades in arms cracked it? Had they, against all odds, against all the mockery and mickey-taking, uncovered a genuine ghost? Well, the ghost was found all right, but not in the way or the form they'd hoped for. In fact, it was uncovered in the pages of the local newspaper, because it seems the ghostly nun was 25 years old, ran a laundrette in Lower Rock Street, and her name was Ted O'Connor. I wore a long dark cloak loaned to me by a girl I know, white makeup and charcoal on my face to emphasize my features, Ted told the newspapers. He'd also enlisted three friends in the endeavor, one of whom had lurked in the bushes playing sound effects. Ted insisted that he hadn't set out to humiliate the Psychic Society, but to prove that they weren't suited to ghost hunting. Ken Sheffield was furious, sending lengthy letters to the newspapers, insisting that he hadn't been duped. The Society would march on, he insisted. It would keep tearing at the veil of the paranormal, whittling away the boundaries between this world and the next. But as the days lengthened, and 1971 was the year that Ireland brought back daylight savings, and as sporting pursuits returned, and as the Eurovision Song Contest from Dublin brought colour television to Irish screens for the very first time, the magic had drained away, and the Tralee Psychic Research Society faded into the yellowing pages of the Kerryman, whence it has never been resurrected until just now by us. Sadly, Ken didn't long outlive the Tralee Psychic Research Society. He died of cancer, still in his 40s, on August 5th, 1975. Let's remember him as a man of sincere beliefs, a man who brightened the dark winter days, and they do get very dark in Kerry, with his broad-minded questing after truth. And let's recall one other curious coda to this story, too. Remember Ted O'Connor? The man whose prank brought the curtain down on the Tralee Psychic Research Society? Well, when Ted found out about the numerous sightings of a ghostly nun around the cottage in Barraduff, around the time of his prank, He was confused. I was dressed as a monk, he told reporters. If people saw a nun, that must have been someone or something else. Do please stay for one more. I don't like the look of those clouds, and the roads could be hazardous in this weather. That reminds me, speaking of motor cars, they do play a surprisingly prominent role in tales of the supernatural here in Ireland. In fact, during the interwar years, from the mid-20s to the late 30s, the roads of the West were positively choked with ghost vehicles. Every western county from Donegal to Kerry has a story of a ghost car blazing its phantom headlamps over the bogs and boreens. One of the more interesting examples comes from the northwestern county of Roscommon in 1926. Perched on the border with County Galway, the Roscommon village of Mount Talbot was the western outpost of the Talbot family, Anglo-Normans who came over with the original wave of invasion in 1177. The main branch of the Talbots embedded itself in Malahide, North County Dublin. If you've ever been to Malahide Castle, then you've been to their former home. They fell in and out of favour with the English authorities, but they always kept their toehold in County Roscommon. And in the 1840s, the ruthlessness of one member of the Talbot family became a national scandal across the United Kingdom. John Talbot Crosby was a minor member of the dynasty, but in 1851 he inherited Mount Talbot from his uncle, William Talbot. However, the bequest came with one fatal proviso. John would need to produce a male son to inherit the house and its lands, or else John would never become its full, lawful owner. Well, John's wife, Marianne, failed to produce a male heir. And John, enraged and embittered and looking to get his hands on the loot, accused Marianne of carrying on with a stable hand. Whether she had or not is a moot point, but the evidence suggests that he simply made the charge up. He filed for divorce, and the case went all the way to the House of Lords, which was the final court of appeal in those days. Not surprisingly, the Lords found in favour of a man who was, to some extent, one of their own. John was granted his divorce, he remarried, but not before he'd had Marianne put away in a mental asylum, where she lived out the rest of her days. But John's new wife did deliver a son, and all John's cruelty and selfishness finally brought him his heart's desire. For all of 2 weeks, that is, before John died suddenly at the age of 40. But the house did pass in time to little Johnny, who grew up to be a noted lover and collector of beautiful things. He left them all behind, though, when the Civil War landed on his doorstep, and Mount Talbot House passed back and forth between Republican and Free State forces. Abandoned by the Talbots, the mansion lay brooding and idle on the fringes of County Roscommon. Abandoned, that is, by the living. On a raw January evening in 1927, four young men from Roscommon piled into a Ford Model T and set out for Mount Talbot. There was a hint of a rumour of a suggestion doing the rounds that a ghost had been seen in the neighbourhood, and the young men were eager to find out for themselves. Well, they found nothing out of the ordinary at the mansion itself, so they extended their ghost hunt, driving over the rugged terrain of Mount Talbot, looking for a sign from the other world. As the young men peered into the black Roscommon night, an enormous white car suddenly erupted from the bog, ablaze with light. It made no sound, but whizzed past the Model T at incredible speed in the direction of Mount Talbot Gate. The phantom car somehow shot through the locked gate and disappeared into the trees beyond, leaving behind neither track nor echo, but some very, very badly shaken young men. Sightings of the car were recorded across Roscommon during that stormy January. During the worst of the storms, the phantom car was spotted lifting into the sky, banking and dipping like an airplane, so witnesses said. Whether or not it really was capable of flight, the car seems to have been indestructible. At Tabarney, it was said that the car had been sliced to pieces by bolts of lightning, and eyewitnesses had seen this happen. Yet somehow, the car was seen intact again the next night near Ochrane, engine humming away as smoothly as ever. Visitors to Mount Talbot, of which there were many as soon as the story spread, also noticed an unearthly whiff of brimstone. Although this seems to have had a very earthly explanation, it seems some furtive poachers had been luring pheasant nearby with sulphur-drenched currants, which accounted for the smell. When local ghost hunters went to investigate, they found a forest clearing littered with doped pheasants and some swift-heeled poachers disappearing into the night. The pheasants eventually came round and lived to be shot another day. So, why was all this happening? Why were phantom luxury cars whizzing about the Roscommon countryside, defying the laws of physics and ruining the livelihoods of honest poachers? Well, the most popular theory ran like this. The last inhabitants of Mount Talbot, little Johnny Talbot and his wife, Lady Julia, had been particularly supportive of the British war effort during the First World War. By the way, every single contemporary reference to Lady Julia mentions her size. She was said to be a woman of almost 20 stone in weight, but she was known for something else too, her support for the Red Cross. Now, this may sound harsh today, but that made her a hated figure in the local area. Anyone seemed to be supporting British imperialism, even in the cause of wounded Irish soldiers, was widely despised in the countryside. It was perhaps the lingering bitterness of Lady Julia's support for the military, more than anything, which caused the estate to be targeted during the War of Independence a few years later, and saw the Talbots abandon the mansion to the IRA, who burnt it down in 1922. Johnny and Julia died in London not long after leaving Ireland. But why had one or both apparently returned at the wheel of a gleaming white automobile from beyond the veil? Locals had little doubt about that one. You see, it seems someone had daubed the words "To Hell with the Red Cross" on the walls of the abandoned mansion. And if ever a phrase was calculated to draw a soul back from across the Great Divide, it was this one. Furious at this slight to her life's work, such as it was, Lady Julia came back with a vengeance. Quite why she chose to do so in a gleaming white motor car is less easily understood. But then why was the Connacht countryside besieged by terror on four wheels during these years? The obvious explanations are, well, obvious. In 1915, there were fewer than 10,000 cars in Ireland. Indeed, that same year, Johnny Talbot himself became the first owner of a car in Roscommon, a Swift. But by the mid-1920s, after Henry Ford had set up shop in Cork, there were tens of thousands of cars on Irish roads, and they were reaching parts of the country that had never known the glare of a headlamp. In those dark and deserted corners of Connacht, the honk of a Model T's horn, the growl of a Rover's engine, could dissolve into the ancient Atlantic mists and merge with the legends and spectres of the West. Mount Talbot House, or the ivy-strewn shell of it, still stands today. It's perhaps less offensive in its ruins than it was in its stolen splendour. There's nothing now of the opulence which once made it one of the finest homes in the West. Today, the N63 road cuts through Mount Talbot. If for some reason Lady Julia were to materialise behind the wheel for another spin around the old homestead, well, would anyone even notice? But if you do want to conjure her, you know where to go, and you know what to write. Now, my friend, it's been delightful to share your company again, but I fear I've kept you long enough. Don't worry about the weather, I've called you a taxi. You see it down there by the railings? Yes, a white car. That'll get you home safely. Only do me a favour and don't try to speak to the driver. He's an excellent driver, but no great raconteur. I suppose when you've been around as long as he has, well, small talk tends to pall a little. Farewell, my friend. And until next we meet, safe travels.